Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. Speaking will be Mark Leonard, Director of Foreign Policy at the Center for European Reform. Introducing our speaker is Professor Vivian Schmidt, Director of the European Studies Program at Boston University. We begin with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Tonight's lecture, Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century, by Mark Leonard, who is sitting here at the table, is organized by the Institute in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. And Vivian Schmidt, Jean Monnet Professor of European Integration in that department, will introduce Mr. Leonard momentarily. As her title indicates, Professor Schmidt is working on the issues of European enlargement and all the problems linked to it, so she may be less optimistic than the title of our lecture indicates. And the title has been chosen, and it's the title of the book by our speaker. I myself am very optimistic about European Union and consider its enlargement one of the most promising phenomena of today, and await with great curiosity what Mr. Leonard has to tell us about it. And now, Professor Schmidt.
I'm delighted to introduce Mark Leonard, one of the leading writers and public commentators on Europe today. Mark's topic for tonight, also the title of his first book, Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century, is a direct challenge to the American naysayers who a few years back were depicting the European Union in highly negative terms. We even heard this here at the Institute for Human Sciences from the likes of Ken Edelman, Max Boot, and Walter Russell Mead. The common wisdom then was that Europe was on a downward trend. The European economy was in the doldrums, given the problems of high unemployment, difficulties of increasing labor market flexibility, and reforming the welfare state. Any hope of a common foreign policy was seen to be in tatters, given the run-up to the Iraq War. Demographics were a disaster, given low birth rates and the need for higher rates of immigration, just as European publics were becoming more insular. Since then, U.S. attitudes have softened. Multilateralism is back to a certain extent, in particular with regard to Iran. But the European economy still seems to be in the doldrums, and demographics are still a disaster. On top of this, most recently, and after Mark's book was published, the EU's constitutional project has stalled in light of the negative votes in the referenda on the constitutional treaty in France and the Netherlands. Of course, there is another side to this story. I've just painted the negative part, the pessimistic part, but we have the optimistic view here. This is the very person, actually, to give us the other side of the story. Mark's book is one of the best and most persuasive accounts to date, explaining why the EU, notwithstanding all that I've just said, will, or at least could, run the 21st century. Perhaps this is a little bit more optimistic than I would be. And the argument, I think it will be, but it's taking a different view on foreign policy through soft power rather than the hard power approach of the U.S., with an economy that's still chugging along nicely, providing its citizens a more livable and leisure-full existence than that of Americans. And as for the demographics of the constitutional treaty, of course, there are many questions that remain. But Mark is one of the best-placed people to answer these and other questions. Mark is director of foreign policy at the London-based Center for European Reform, where he writes on Europe's relations with the United States, the Middle East, and China. He also writes regular features for the Financial Times magazine, assignments which have led him to seek out barbecues in Texas, prisons in Egypt, and cutting-edge architecture in China. A recent article in Prospect was entitled Drinking the Kool-Aid, which was on Iraq and the U.S. That one needs to be read. He's done papers on Iran and in foreign policy. Just before the French voted no, he wrote a piece on why Europe would survive a French no. Mark is a member of the British government's Public Diplomacy Strategy Board, which advises the Foreign Secretary on how to present Britain around the world. He was responsible for drafting a public diplomacy strategy for the British government in the Middle East after September 11. Mark has also worked with the European Commission on communicating Europe, with the Norwegian government on Norwegian public diplomacy, and with the National Audit Office, British Audit Office, on blue sky thinking, on ways of measuring foreign policy effectiveness. As a true Renaissance man, Mark also collaborates regularly with the Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas for clients ranging from the European Commission to Prada. Before this, until the beginning of 2005, Mark was director of the Foreign Policy Center, a think tank he helped found at the age of 24 under the patronage of the British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Immediately before that, he worked for Demos, where he ran the Europe program. In 2004, Mark was selected for the German Marshall Fund's prestigious Transatlantic Fellowship, which allowed him to spend 5 months in Washington, D.C., which he used to write this book, as well as travel widely around the U.S. Mark travels regularly not only around America, but also the Middle East and China, as well as the European Union. As a child, he lived in Brussels for 12 years, where he picked up fluent French and German, which we may very well test him on later. And with that, I give you Mark Leonard.
Thank you very much. I'm blushing after that introduction. Whenever people talk about the future in kind of grand sweeping terms, I'm reminded of an anecdote about the German poet Heinrich Heine, where he was asked where he would like to be at the end of the world, and he replied without a second's hesitation that it would be in England, because he said everything happens 100 years later there. I'm starting with that partly to situate what I'm going to say in the lecture tonight. I work for a think tank called the Centre for European Reform, spend most of my days talking about problems with the European Union and ways of solving them. And my colleagues work on everything from demographics to defence spending to economic reform to the absurdity of the common agricultural policy. And I can probably produce a longer list of European problems than any of the people who obituarize Europe on a daily basis. But in spite of that, I do think that on many of those issues, European leaders are starting to grapple with them and are starting to chart ways forward. But I also think that underneath this superficial set of failures and of problems that we read about every day in the newspapers is a deeper and more profound success story, an extraordinary tale of how a continent that was riven with internal wars has made conflict between its major powers impossible, of how wave after wave of countries has been brought out of dictatorship and into democracy. And a very strange tale of economic catch-up, how a continent that was whose economy was completely destroyed by the Second World War has managed to move from having a GDP that was less than half of the size of the US to one which isn't that much smaller than the United States. And these stories of success tend to be hidden from the public view because they're things which historians can tell and can spot, but they don't fit into the neat pattern of 24-hour news. And because the EU is reported by journalists rather than historians, that longer-term success story is something which is completely lost. And when I was writing the book, I spent some time in public libraries, and I looked through media coverage of Europe over the last 50 years, and you could tell if you open any newspaper at random on any day, you read this kind of familiar tale of failures and disasters, of targets missed and divisions and an inability to agree on anything or to do anything. And most people, I think, reading the newspapers, would think that the European Union would be lucky to get through to the end of the year in one piece, let alone to run a century. But what I'm hoping to do tonight is to take a step back and to think not just about what Europe is at the moment and to look at that through different eyes, but also to think about what it could be and to see what some of the features of the European project are which have allowed it to achieve this extraordinary success over 50 years and which I think could end up having a much wider application than the European Union and act as a model or an inspiration to other parts of the world as well. And I'm going to start by going back in history to a famous myth, the myth of Tantalus. And I think it's important when we think about Europe to remember the fate of Tantalus, the ancient king of Sipylus in Asia Minor, upset the gods by serving his son up at a dinner party and not telling the gods what they were eating, and was punished for this act of misbehavior. He was sentenced to a life of perpetual frustration. The gods immersed him up to his neck in water, but as soon as he bent to drink it, the water swept away. Above his head, there were luscious fruit hanging from branches, but every time he tried to reach for them, the wind would blow them just beyond his reach. And the gods could have done anything they wanted to him. They could have smitten him from the face of the earth, but I think they realized that they would make him suffer far more by dangling all of these possibilities in front of it and then just withdrawing them at the last possible minute. Well, Tantalus and his fate, I think, is maybe the best illustration of how the European Union wields its power today. The kingdom of Sipylus is in modern-day Turkey, and Tantalus's successors in the Turkish government today, I think, couldn't recognise its plight. Turkey first applied to join the European Union in 1963, and for four decades it's had the prospect of membership dangled in front of it, but then removed because of failings of the Turkish government every single time it looked like it was going to be possible. And in Turkey today, the prospect of joining the European club has become one of the few things that secularists and Islamists, that Anatolians and Kurds and Armenians can all agree on, because it's something that promises them all a better future. And the results on Turkish politics over the last few years have been absolutely incredible. Eight harmonization packages have gone through parliament. Things like the death penalty and torture in prisons and restrictions on Kurdish language, and even the country's long-standing position on things as sensitive as Cyprus have been moderated to allow the country to realise its European dream. And it's a dream which came a step closer last year when the European Union started formal negotiations over Turkish accession. And the reason for this extraordinary change to the domestic politics of Turkey, at a time when it was actually reacting quite hostilely against American pressure to join in and to support the Iraq war or to be the loyal ally that it had been for so many years beforehand, is there for one reason alone, which is this Turkish desire to join the European Union. And I think that what's happening in Turkey today does mark an important shift in politics, which is the rise of the European Union as a shaper of global politics. And it's something which, for the reasons that Vivian talked about earlier, I think has been missed. And so what I'd like to do in the talk today is really to do two things. First of all, to explain why, in spite of all the doom and gloom and Euroscepticism and decline, I had the audacity to write a book arguing that it was Europe and not America or China that will set the rules for the 21st century. And then I'm going to talk a bit about why I still believe it's true, even in spite of the no votes in France and Holland, but also how the European political project will need to adapt to respond to that political crisis which those two no votes unleashed. So I'll start with European power. We're used to the abject sight of European leaders travelling across the Atlantic, cap in hand, begging America for help and to solve problems that Europeans can't solve on their own. And I'm a passionate Atlanticist, and I'm very grateful for the fact that assistance has been forthcoming in the Second World War, in the Balkans, in the 1990s. But what is interesting is today we're seeing a less familiar sight, which is America needing Europe's help in many of the parts of the world that it cares the most about, whether it was in Kiev or Tbilisi during the Orange and Rose revolutions, or whether it's in Sarajevo or Ankara or Ramallah or even Tehran. It's the European Union that is setting the pace for global diplomacy and working often with the United States to make events move in the right direction. If you look at the most important things on the Bush administration's agenda, whether it's spreading democracy in the Middle East and the former Soviet bloc, whether it's dealing with weapons of mass destruction in Iran, whether it's the European Union is at the very least a key part of any solution. But in some ways, it is the critical part and even more important than the United States of America. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why the anti-Europeanism of this administration has been moderated in the second term. And it's also, I think, one of the reasons why George Bush's first state visit after he was re-elected was to Brussels rather than Beijing or Delhi or Moscow. Because I think there was a realization that without European diplomacy, money and soft power, the March of Freedom would be a lot more halting than it is today. And that's why I think that, and when I was writing the book, I felt very strongly that for all the talk of American empire, the last few years have told us more about the limits of American power and above all, the particular model of power, which was epitomized so completely by the Bush administration in the first term. That dominance is something which was clear-cut on two levels, both the ability to fight and win intensive conventional wars and also the ubiquity of American popular culture. But I think that in an age of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, we've seen how the desperate and the weak can neutralize or frustrate even a superpower. And this came out most strongly for me in Fallujah, when we saw the sort of impotence of the international community when faced with a few thugs in a small village in and the amount of time it took to try and pacify and bring the situation there under control. But I think even more important than that, we've seen that the more the Bush administration has resorted to employing hard power, the greater the damage has been to the country's soft power. And we're now in a situation where, for the first time probably in about 50 years, America does not stand everywhere in the world for all that's aspirational, that's cool, that is desirable. And whilst many people feel very grateful to America for the role that it played over the last 50 years and have a huge amount of respect for the American people, America is something that polarizes as much as it attracts today. And I think that's very much due to the model of power in which the Bush administration was exercising. And I think at the same time that that was going on, what we've seen quietly, almost invisibly, is the development of a different sort of power in Europe, one which works in a different way according to different timescales, which is not so much about getting your way in the short term, but is more, as I hinted at earlier, about reshaping the world in the long term. It's a kind of power that can't be measured in the traditional ways that we've thought about power, simply in terms of the size of the economy, the size of the army, the sophistication of the weapons that the countries that wield this power have. But it's seen in more subtle terms through the ability of countries to use the law, to use treaties, to use norms to reshape the world. And that kind of power is one which I call transformative power. And my book really is about this new transformative power and the impact that it could have beyond the European continent. And in my talk tonight, I'm going to look at some of the five ways in which one can think about transformative power. And then I'll talk, as I said earlier, about Europe after the referendum. So the first thing to know about transformative power is that it's easy to miss. So easy to miss that it's usually confused with weakness, because Europe's promise to the world is not based on a European dream or a bold vision of the future. Instead, it's driven by a desire to evade the past by cooperating in the present. For me, the best definition ever of European integration comes from a line written by the French poet Paul Valéry, where he says, "We hope vaguely, we dread precisely." In other words, the EU draws its energy from this negative impulse to evade the past rather than a blueprint for the future. And that's why European integration works like an invisible hand through a series of technical agreements on tariffs, on shared regulations in a single market, where instead of trying to create a vast European bureaucracy that's based in Brussels, it works through the shell of traditional national political structure. So the British Parliament, the French Parliament, the Spanish Parliament are all there. They look pretty much, and the government and the judges all look very much as they have done for hundreds of years. But in fact, they've all become agents of the European Union, implementing European law and European policies and spending European money. And the reason that Euroscepticism, though it does exist, is not more widespread than it is because the development of the European Union has not been at the expense of people's national identities and their national political systems. It's been about transforming those systems rather than replacing them. And I think the same logic applies to the European Union when it engages in the rest of the world. When European troops serve overseas, they usually don't do it with a European flag. They tend to serve under a United Nations or a NATO or a national banner. And as a result, they don't provoke the sort of resistance around the world that American troops do. So whilst every American embassy, company, military base is seen as a sort of outpost for the American dream and a provocation in many parts of the world, particularly the Middle East, the EU, because it's less visible, because it is less associated with a particular philosophy in people's minds, is also less likely to create provocation. But as a result, you can miss the fact that anything's happening at all. If you type the words Europe and crisis into Google, as I did before the French and Dutch referendums, I found that over 4 million entries came up. And the media use these terms together so often that they are almost interchangeable. And that's because people don't join the dots of the European Union. They don't see this power as it emerges. And that really relates to the second feature of the European Union, which is the fact that it's not a state. It doesn't have a single telephone number, as Kissinger suggested it should do, and it never will. My advice to Henry Kissinger is to go out and buy a phone book, because there will always be a number of different people to call if you want to talk to the European Union, because that is the key to Europe's power. I've spoken a bit already about how this is a strength, because it internally allows the European Union to create power and resources out of nothing. By coming together in this way, European countries have created a home market of almost half a million consumers, which is pretty remarkable if you come from Luxembourg, a country with 400,000 citizens, that your home market is 450 million consumers. But it also allows you to work together to deal with problems that cut across borders, whether it's organized crime or terrorism or migration. And it does this without asking you to compromise your independence. But what's maybe even more interesting about the fact that the EU structure and the way that power is shared along a network is its impact on foreign policy, because it's allowed Europe to end one of the oldest laws of international relations, which has been the key rule of the last 500 years or so, which is the balance of power. I don't think a great power in the history of the world has risen like the European Union without provoking its neighbours to organise against it. What's extraordinary about the European Union is the more powerful it becomes, the longer the line of countries is that want to join it, and the more popular it is in the world. And the reason for this, I think, relates to the third feature of transformative power, which is the fact that the European Union doesn't project power by threatening to interfere in other countries' internal affairs, by threatening, at the end of the day, potentially to invade them. The worst thing that the European Union can do to other countries, its most powerful threat, is to do absolutely nothing at all. What I mean is the worst thing it can do is to threaten to cut off contact, not to interfere in other countries' internal affairs, to close off the possibility of trading with it, to close off the possibility of one day joining the European Union. Because if you're in government in Bosnia, in Turkey or the Ukraine, the only thing that you fear more than having a group of Brussels bureaucrats coming down and telling you how to revamp your social, economic and political systems is the threat of them not coming at all. And this lure of one day joining the European Union is so powerful that we've seen wave after wave of countries, whether it was Spain and Greece in the 1980s or Poland and the Czech Republic in the 1990s and early years of this century, or Turkey in the future, changing simply because they want one day to be part of the European club. And to see how remarkable it is, I think we should compare Europe's neighbourhood policy with the neighbourhood policy of other great powers, like Russia, for instance, which treats its neighbours as if they're part of a soft empire. It does offer lots of very attractive resources to them, whether it's access to their market or cheap energy. But the price is for them to bend their political ambitions and their political needs to what the government of the day in Moscow requires. It's not about changing their societies from the inside or setting out a series of rules or laws or norms for them to adhere to. It's very much about the narrow self-interest of Moscow at a particular time and a sense of loyalty to Moscow rather than loyalty to other parts of the world. And I think a similar thing is true if you look at the way that the US deals with its neighbours, where the number one concern is less what the legal or political system in its neighbours is than the national interests of the United States of America at that particular moment. And in my book, I contrast, for example, the European Union's approach to Serbia and the US approach to Colombia, both very troubled countries on our respective doorsteps, both countries where military intervention has occasionally been necessary. But whereas the European Union offers Serbia the chance to be integrated into a multilateral community with it, the chance of structural funds and transfers of wealth from us to them, the offer to the main concern of the US with Colombia is the war on drugs, and the means tend to be military. Even though a lot of money and aid is given, the concern is above all to stem the flow of drugs rather than to sort out the political system within Colombia. And I think at the heart of that is the fourth feature of transformative power, which is the law. In the run-up to the Iraq War, I think one of the most powerful symbols which was discussed was this idea of Europe as a modern-day Prometheus, a continent that bound itself so tightly in red tape that it was incapable of doing anything at all. Europe's obsession with the law was almost the perfect counterfoil to the pyrotechnic might of the US military. But in fact, I think that rather than being seen as a source of weakness, Europe's obsession with the law is maybe one of the most important ways that it projects power around the world. And we can see very clearly that whilst military power can allow us to change regimes in places like Afghanistan or Iraq, it's the law which has allowed the European Union to change all of Polish society, from its economic policies to its property laws to its treatment of minorities. And that's because every single country that joins the European Union has to absorb 80,000 pages of European laws in 34 volumes that govern everything from gay rights to food safety. And once countries have done that, have democratically passed these laws within them. They're changed forever. So unlike military power, which depends on your troops being on the ground and your political attention being focused on that country, because as soon as your back is turned, your potency starts to wane. If a country goes through this process of legal transformation, it is changed forever and has done it of its own free will and of its own accord. And that really brings me to the fifth and final point I want to make about European power, which is the fact that I think it is a paradigm-changing event. Many people have told me that they think that my arguments are interesting, but the title of my book is preposterous, the idea that Europe will run the 21st century. It's a ridiculous overstatement of my case. So, in fact, I'd like to argue that maybe it's underselling my case, because it sounds like I'm arguing that Europe will do well in the 21st century, in the same way that there were books appearing in the past about the kind of Japanese and the German economic miracles, and shares go up and down in particular parts of the world, and we all hear that it's going to be a Chinese century now. But in fact, what I'm saying is not that Europe or European countries will do particularly well in the 21st century, because I don't think any European country will be in the top 10 economies by the end of the century. But I think that the European system will change the world, because though European power doesn't yet have the same global scope as the US, Brussels has got very little influence in North Korea or in Pakistan, it is spreading in three very important ways. First, it's spreading within the European continent and within its neighbourhood. Beyond the 450 million citizens who are already living in the European Union, there are another 1.5 billion people in about 80 countries that are umbilically linked to the European Union, because it's their main source of aid, their main source of trade, their main source of investment, and many of them have currencies that are linked to the euro. And this is what I call the Eurosphere. It's Europe's growing zone of influence. And what is interesting about the way that the EU is interacting with these countries is that it is applying some of the things which have been so successful towards countries that have joined it in the past, by making its relationships with those countries conditional on them meeting certain standards, whether it's human rights or proliferation or migration. And if that happens, you could see almost a third of the world brought into this European sphere of influence being changed by the European way of doing things. But I think even more important than that is the fact that the European Union is the only part of the world that is genuinely interested in global institutions and in setting up rules to deal with an age of globalization. In the last period of major global instability, it was the United States that led the world and made the world safe by setting up the Bretton Woods institutions. But it's interesting that in the post-Cold War world, it's Europeans who pioneered the creation of the World Trade Organization. On climate change, after President Bush said that Kyoto was dead, it was Europeans that ratified and implemented it and bullied the Russians to signing up as well. And the same happened with the International Criminal Court. And when it comes to regulation of the global economy, even the mighty Microsoft has to march to rules which are written in Brussels. But even more important than that, I think, is the way that the European model is spreading like a virus. There isn't a single continent in the world where countries are not coming together and creating their own neighbourhood clubs which are modelled on the European Union. I spend a lot of my time in East Asia and travel to China every couple of months. And what's interesting about East Asia is the fact that the big idea which has gripped the attention of think tanks and academics in the last few years is the idea of building an East Asian community with its own currency and its own market, which will allow China to change its relationship with its neighbours and to give them a stake in Chinese growth. But the same is happening in Africa with the Organization of African Unity, which has renamed itself the African Union so that it can model itself on the European Union. And in Latin America, with Mercosur. And what I think these countries realise is that the EU has allowed, as I said before, European countries to put historical differences behind them, to create solutions to cross-border problems, to create a big market, and to allow tiny countries like Luxembourg or Belgium to have a voice on global issues, even in an era of American hegemony and global capitalism. And that's why I think increasingly other parts of the world are starting to develop this model, and together, collectively, they will have an impact on the way that the world is run. And the closest parallel, I think, for this process was another European invention developed about 500 years ago, which was the European, which was the idea of the nation state, which was so much more effective than any other form of political organisation that other systems had a very clear choice, which was to become a nation state themselves and stop being a feudal economy or a religious state or whatever other system they had, or get taken over by one. And I think 50 years ago, Europeans went back and they reinvented the nation state and came up with this new model, which means that other parts of the world are facing an equally stark choice, either to join the European Union or to develop their own regional club based on the same principles of peace, mutual interference, and the rule of law. And as this process unfolds, I think that we'll see that the 21st century will come to be seen as a new European century, not because, as I said, European countries will be the most powerful or the biggest or the most economically successful, but because the European way of doing things will have become the world's. Well, that was the argument that I was making before the referendum results in France and Holland. And I think it is legitimate to ask me how Europe can hope to run a century if it can't even agree on its own constitution. But I think that whilst the French and Dutch no votes swept through Europe's political class like a tsunami, destroying political careers, emasculating the European treaty, and possibly even putting a full stop on 20 years of European integration led by elites from above by treaties, what it didn't do was to kill the European project or the European future. It's obvious that the results of the 80,000 pages that I talked about before, the single market, the single currency, will remain intact in spite of these referendums. So that 50 years of history is not affected by the French and the Dutch no votes. But I also think that there could be a more positive outcome of the no votes as well, which is a collective debate within Europe which faces up to some of the reasons why people voted no and which will allow them to develop a different model for European integration in the future. Because for 50 years, the main battles in Europe were about how much Europe was needed and what kind of and different definitions of the national interest. Citizens were not directly involved. But because they felt that Europe made them richer and safer, they trusted governments to work out the details of European integration. So during that phase, Europe was being built from nothing. So progress was measured in terms of the number of treaties that could be signed. And because Europe was relatively homogenous, the assumption was that things should be done in a sort of one-size-fits-all way. It might take some countries to a bit longer to catch up with other things, but these were traditional arrangements, and everyone would end up in exactly the same place at the end. And there were two dominant ways of thinking about the way forward. One was inspired by an Italian member of the European Parliament called Spinelli, who had this idea, this sort of federalist idea, that Europe would be based on a constitutional structure. And the other model was the functionalist, inspired by Jean Monnet, who thought that Europe would be built discreetly, issue by issue, one issue at a time, without involving the public. And today, after the no votes, we've seen that both groups have come back out of the woodwork. On the one hand, you have the federalists, led by the Luxembourg Prime Minister, Jean-Claude Juncker, who think that the solution to the no votes is simply to ignore them and to carry on ratifying the treaties, and then go back to France and Holland and tell them about the error of their ways, maybe add in a couple of protocols on social policy to make the process less unpleasant, but get them to vote the right way. In the other camp, led by the French, we have the incrementalists, who think that the solution is to try and sort of calm things down. The problem with the European Constitution, it was overhyped. It should never have been called a constitution. We need to just call it a treaty. And then we can save the most important bits, like the foreign minister, the composition of the commission, the voting weights. And then having done that, we can go back to national parliaments and get them to vote it through and not bother with any of these kind of messy referendums, which often end up making the wrong decisions anyway. And what's more, they've worked out when to do it, because in 2008 or 2009, when Croatia joins the European Union, all parliaments are going to have to ratify a Croatian accession treaty, and we can just add a protocol in with these constitutional changes, and hey presto, we'll have the best bits of the treaty implemented into European law. Unfortunately, I think neither group understands how much the European Union has changed, because that old model of integration by treaty is under quite a major threat from three challenges. First, the growing diversity of the European Union, which means that a one-size-fits-all model is very difficult. And we saw this very clearly with the debate about the Services Directive, which is trying to create a single market for services as well as a single market for goods. And I was in Germany a few weeks ago, and people around Merkel were saying that they would have supported the Services Directive without any hesitation in a Europe of 15 countries, because levels of economic welfare was quite similar. But there are all these fears of social dumping and of national systems being undermined, because some of the new member states have got much lower wage levels and other levels than the EU. So I think that's one, and you see that being replicated in all sorts of other areas. Second problem is this deficit of consent, where we have this horrendous paradox that Europe is at its least popular at the time when popularity matters the most. As I said earlier, citizens have never been involved in the big decisions about widening or deepening the European Union in the past, but they will be in the future, because there is this new vogue for direct democracies. Many countries will have to have referendums in the future if any new treaties are passed. But equally, if the European Union is going to enlarge after Croatia, there will have to be referendums in France, because they've changed their constitution, and maybe in other countries. The third deficit is a delivery deficit, which is the fact that most people think that they need European solutions to problems which cut across borders, but they don't trust the European Union to deliver it. So in order to deal with these three deficits, we need a new approach to the European Union, which is for a mature Europe that's political rather than just technocratic, that's diverse rather than homogenous, and that will need to be delivering for its people rather than being built from scratch. And for want of a better word, I call this new approach democratic functionalism. It's got three elements. Essentially, I think the first response has to be declaring a moratorium on new treaties. Part of this is inevitable, because we're not going to have any new treaties for a few years anyway. The French and the Dutch have said that they're not going to vote again on this one. But I think we should make a virtue out of necessity and show that the European Union is capable of listening. But above all, using this absence of treaties to make Europe work better in the areas that people care about: foreign policy, migration and security, the single market and its completion, and create what the French call an Europe des projets, Europe that's capable of delivering for its citizens. And I think that will give it more legitimacy. But that links into the second response, which I think has to be thinking again about how we involve European citizens in the creation of European treaties. Because eventually, I think, we will have to go back and look at Europe's political structure and see how we can improve the way that it delivers in these areas. But when we do that, the solution won't be to create a vague catch-all constitution like the constitutional treaty, which has just been rejected. But instead, I think we'll have to learn two things. One, you need to have much narrower treaties with a single purpose so that people can see why they're being asked to support it. And secondly, you're going to need more coordination between countries that choose to hold referendums. Because I think last time they felt that by having a bandwagon, you could create a bandwagon effect by having the most pro-European countries like Spain go first and the least pro-European countries like Britain go last, and that eventually there'd be this kind of wave of enthusiasm that would develop across the European Union, which would make even Eurosceptic countries vote yes. But that unfortunately didn't work. Instead, we had a kind of negative bandwagon where after the French no, the Dutch voted no. I think part of the problem is that if you hold the referendums like that, they become simply national questions, and people are likely to vote no just to give a particularly terrible or unpopular government like Jacques Chirac a bloody nose. And to be honest, I can understand the temptation, even as a pro-European. So that really brings me to the third response, and I will end there, which is that if you do start involving people in the construction of Europe, they're not always going to say yes, they're not always going to be well-behaved. And that's why we shouldn't assume that everyone is going to want to be part of everything as we move forward. We need to end the idea of thinking of a European Union and start thinking about multiple European Unions. We've heard I think the 80,000 pages, which I described before, will have to remain intact, because you can't have a single market and a single... you can't have a functioning single market if you start allowing people to pick and choose which bits of the Ecumenical Dell that we have at the moment they want to keep. But I think in the future, we need to get ready to think of of different countries coming together and cooperating in practical ways in areas which are not covered by the existing treaties. And further integration will, I think, be driven by pioneer groups rather than by treaties. You can imagine, for example, the group of countries that have removed their border controls under the Schengen Agreement coming together and cooperating more on security, or the Eurozone countries harmonising their tax bases, or the particularly bloodthirsty and aggressive countries that want to have a more military-orientated foreign policy, like Britain and France, coming together and creating a kind of expeditionary Europe. But equally, I think we're going to need to think again about how we engage countries outside of the European Union, because one of the most difficult things at the moment, I went to Belarus last week and was in Georgia last year, and the fact that whilst there is no consensus to move forward on enlargement, we've got nothing to say to countries on our periphery, because the neighbourhood policy, which I talked about earlier, hasn't yet developed into what it could be. And I think we need to think also about whether... as we can start offering something short of membership to countries on the European periphery so that they have some incentives to change before they're ready for full membership. Anyway, that's the heart of what I think could be a new approach. To European federalists, the ideas will seem quite uninspiring. To incrementalists, they'll seem crazy because people are so unreliable and apt to vote the wrong way. But what I think they are about is about adapting some of the most successful ideas of the EU founders to an age of democracy. And I think now is the time to do it, because if my basic hunch about the European Union is right, that it's only ever moved forward as a result of failure, that it's drawn its energy from negative events rather than from positive ideas, the no vote, I think, could create a platform for a new and more self-confident Europe, and a way of embodying what I think is one of the most important bits of advice that the European Union has ever received, which comes from Samuel Beckett, who said that if at first you don't succeed, try again, fail again, fail better. And I think the genius of the European Union is that it does keep on trying. Thank you.
Wonderful account. And I think tremendously important to talk about the deeper, more profound success story that is Europe. Most importantly, I think, is what you said about the EU being a different kind of entity, not a nation state. I would call it a regional state, but I'm happy with some kind of regional entity, as you were talking about. And also is in your conclusion about the EU really having variable boundaries, variable policy areas, I think that's very important. The only problem with that is the more varied it gets, what happens internally. And also for the very issues of democracy that you raise, and not simply for the original member states, the original six, but 12, 15. I mean, it becomes very hard to manage to even imagine what it is. So that would be one question. And another question is, it is the title, will it run the 21st century? And it seems to me you've really talked about the EU as a shaper of global politics, but not a maker of global politics. So is it that it will run the 21st century, or that it will run alongside other powers like the US or China? I know your argument is that it's the norms, it's the projection, it's the power of attraction that it might set the terms of the way in which the 21st century is run. But will it run it is another question. And then I guess I think the most important point, which you actually did a very nice job of responding to, is what next? What about this democratic deficit? You make a very powerful set of arguments about how the EU is expanding, it's the norms, it's the projection outward of norms of a kind of power that's tremendously powerful. But what about internally? It has transformative power outside to democratize, but inside, isn't it falling apart? And one thing that you do mention the referenda, but you don't mention the rise of the extreme right parties. You don't mention the problems of immigration and anti-immigration, the slowdown of the European economy, the services directive may be just a sign of increasing unwillingness to continue to integrate the European economy, the economic patriotism that France and Spain now allegedly have and that Italy lost after getting rid of its head of the bank, allegedly. Those are some of the sort of some of the policy issues, but I think the most important question is what about the national level? You actually answer some of that. You're right. National publics don't feel that they have any political say anymore, if they ever did, of what happens in Brussels. But it's also a question of politics. It's a question of the political structures. Is that the EU doesn't allow them to have any direct say. There's no political EU, which means that they're constantly actually, you know, if they can't throw the scoundrels out at the EU level, they simply do it at the national level over and over and over again. So perhaps the problem is not so much the EU, but what's happening at the national level. And I will leave it at that.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Institute for Human Sciences in cooperation with the Department of International Relations at Boston University. Speaking was Mark Leonard, Director of Foreign Policy at the Center for European Reform. Introducing our speaker was Professor Vivian Schmidt, Director of the European Studies Program at Boston University. We began with a greeting by Institute for Human Sciences Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skoog with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.